to express themselves, whatever they want to say, whatever is deep and meaningful to them, and to enter it into Casa de Colores, House of Colors, which is on the website of the Library of Congress, that so I can put out those words for everyone to see. So it's writing, speaking, and then taking it out once again into the public's eye.
Your comments on presidential candidate Donald Trump saying that all 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country should be deported?
Well, you know, it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing to, and this is just in general for sure, it's not a good thing to bring about more division. You know, from my experience, from my family's experience, from the experience of the communities that I know and visit throughout the United States, we work very hard, and we live and die in those fields. And we need support, resources, education, educational resources, and not those kind of comments.
I want to thank you so much. Juan Felipe Herrera recently became the first Latino U.S. poet laureate. And that does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland. The time is 5 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Call Out for Justice and the Wars. Rally and march on Sunday, October 11th, starting at 1 p.m. at Shemansky Park in Portland. Over 35-piece environmental, police accountability, and other social justice groups from the Portland area will be mobilizing around the 14th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, with the march and rally to stop the wars overseas on the people, on human rights, and on the planet. Again, it's a call out for justice and the wars. Sunday, October 11th at 1 p.m., beginning at Shemansky Park, the South Park blocks at Salmon Street in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is seeking an individual or group to contract with to help build our next 3-year strategic plan. KBOO embodies equitable social change, shares knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. We've been serving the Portland community since 1968 and are one of the oldest independent community radio stations in the country. The person or group who is selected will co-lead the development of a strategic plan with the KBOO Strategic Planning Support Work Group, made up of volunteers, board members, and staff. More details about the application process can be found at kboo.fm/planRFP2015.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, there have been 2 more school shootings today.
The family of Walter Scott, killed by police last spring, has been awarded a $6.5 million settlement.
And the third intifada may be coming soon.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 9th, 2015. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. The Wickiup Reservoir south of Bend and the Prineville Reservoir north of the city have reached their lowest points in more than 20 years. Wickiup is a major water source for the farms in Jefferson County. It's currently at less than 10% of its capacity. Normally, it would be 32% full. In addition, the Prineville Reservoir is at its lowest level since 1992. Low snowpack and continuing drought are the cause of the seriously depleted reservoirs throughout the state.
The Wallowa-Whitman National Forest is proposing one of its larger timber sales in the last 25 years. The East Face Project is proposed to be on the east slopes of the northern Elkhorn Mountains in Baker County. It includes about 48,000 acres of public land, mostly national forest, with about 1,200 acres of BLM land. According to the 293-page environmental assessment by the Forest Service, the East Face Project is designed to reduce the risk of large wildfires in the area and to begin to restore forests that have been damaged by logging from the past and many decades of fire suppression. The project is also supposed to support similar work on adjoining private lands, which is a campaign that involves the Oregon Department of Forestry and the U.S. National Resources Conservation Service, or the NRCS. Last year, the NRCS distributed $1.4 million to private landowners to help pay to thin out about 3,100 acres of overcrowded forests in the East Face area. The East Face project would expand that effort into public lands. A 30-day comment period for the East Face environmental assessment started Wednesday. The Wallowa-Whitman's proposed action, which is one of five strategies analyzed in the assessment, calls for commercial logging on 6,700 acres, with a total timber volume of 16.4 million board feet. That's more timber than the 2.4 million acre Wallowa-Whitman has offered for sale in some years. Some of the East Face logging is proposed within designated old growth areas. That would require the Forest Service to amend the 1990 management plan for the Wallowa-Whitman. The East Face project does not, however, call for cutting trees more than 21 inches in diameter. The Forest Service agreed to that limitation for national forests east of the Cascades in the early 1990s because, as environmental organizations had pointed out, most of the old-growth trees were cut down in past decades. This proposed action involves building 5.3 miles of temporary road, rebuilding 53 miles of existing roads, and temporarily opening 107 miles of closed roads. The alternative, which is number two in the study, calls for cutting small trees and piling on 10,000 acres of brush for lighting prescribed fires on about 6,700 acres. Baker County Commissioner Mark Bennett said yesterday that he hopes the East Face project goes ahead as planned.
Today, the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court issued a nationwide stay against enforcement of a regulation issued by the EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The new regulations redefine the waters of the United States, known as the WOTUS rule, and were intended to clarify the scope of the regulations presented in the Clean Water Act, originally passed in 1972, but was amended more recently as the Water Quality Act in 1987. The main controversy stems from the wording, which only vaguely defines and broadens definitions of features like tributaries, adjacent waters, and waters having, quote, a significant nexus to navigable waters. By enlarging the area of control, the overall result would be a greater degree of impact that the EPA has on the use of watersheds, wetlands, and other water-related environments. Numerous challenges against the WOTUS rule are pending in courts around the country. 13 states have already issued stays to forestall implementation of the new WOTUS rule. In an effort to prevent the state-by-state refutation of the rule, the federal court announced the national stay until further discussions can be held.
Marine corals are currently experiencing a mass die-off known as a global bleaching event for the third time since researchers first observed this phenomenon in the late 90s. Reefs are turning white and dying as a result of increasing water temperatures in every major ocean basin around the world. FSRN's Nell Abram reports.
Scientists predict that within 1 year, more than 4,500 square miles of coral reefs will die. That's according to a report released Thursday by an international coalition of ocean experts, reef mappers, and monitoring teams documenting the worldwide coral bleaching crisis. Richard Vivers, project director for the XL Catlin Seaview Survey, one of the teams involved in the study, says climate change is the primary cause.
What's happened is the base temperature of the oceans have risen to such a degree that now the coral reefs are no longer able to cope with what are normal fluctuations in temperatures, so normal peaks in temperatures in El Nino years. And so what we're finding with this El Nino year is coral reefs are starting to die en masse.
The first two documented global bleaching events occurred in 1998 and 2010. Vivers says the outlook this year is grim for both marine ecosystems and the people who rely on them for their livelihoods.
Coral reefs are hugely important. About 500 million people worldwide rely on coral reefs for both income and food. And so losing those coral reefs, it has major knock-on implications.
While corals are capable of regenerating, marine protection is vital to creating the conditions necessary for reef resiliency. Researchers say that ensuring high water quality and sustaining grazing fish populations are key for coral regrowth and call for quick and coordinated monitoring of the mass coral mortality event. Nell Abram, FSRN, Tampa.
There was another school shooting early this morning. One person was killed and three injured at Northern Arizona University. The shooter was a freshman and apparently was involved in altercation in a parking lot around 1:20 a.m. The person killed was also a freshman. And there was another shooting at Texas Southern University this morning around 11:30 a.m. local time. This was the second shooting at that campus this week. Houston police say they have a suspect in custody, and the campus was on lockdown for a few hours before classes were canceled for the rest of the day. This is the third school shooting this month, and so far this year there have been 46. That averages out to just a little over one school shooting per week in the United States.
Data compiled by the crowdsourced internet site Mass Shooting Tracker reveals that there is a mass shooting nearly every day in the United States. Over the past 1,004 days, there have been 994 of them. In total, there are some 30,000 or more gun deaths every year in the U.S., most of them involving a single homicide or suicide. Mass shootings are defined as four or more people shot in one incident. Senate Democrats, including Ron Wyden of Oregon, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Claire McCaskill, announced this week they would introduce a set of gun control measures in yet another attempt to address the U.S.'s problem with gun violence. This is in response to the incident last week in Roseburg, where nine people were shot and killed at Umpqua Community College. Measures proposed would improve background checks and prevent illegal purchase of guns. This, like previous proposals, however, are expected to fail in the Republican-controlled Senate.
The family of Walter Scott has won a $6.5 million settlement. Scott was murdered by the police, shot in the back by South Carolina police last April. Scott was unarmed, and the video captured on cell phone clearly shows Officer Michael Slager calmly and methodically taking aim and firing eight shots. Slager originally claimed that Scott had tried to grab his gun and taser, but the video shows that when he was done shooting, Slager walked back to his car to get his taser and return to the body of the man he had just killed. He then dropped the taser by the body, effectively planting it. Slager was indicted on a murder charge, facing 30 years to life. He's being held without bail. The judge says that his release would constitute an unreasonable danger to the community. Anthony Scott said the family plans to donate some of the money from the settlement to disaster relief for victims of the recent floods in South Carolina.
Assessing the number of people who die while in police custody has proved challenging, because fewer than half the expected number of homicides by law enforcement officers over an eight-year period were identified. According to analysis by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, just 49% of approximately 7,500 police homicides were actually counted during the eight-year period, while the FBI's reports 46%. This leaves a 28% gap of law enforcement homicides in the U.S. that were not recorded on either system. Congress reauthorized a law in 2013 that requires law enforcement to gather information on in-custody deaths, and the Bureau of Justice Statistics said it's trying to establish a more centralized method for identifying arrest-related deaths.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin at 5:30. This will be followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with low around 62. Saturday, there will be rain, mainly after 11 a.m. The high will be near 68. Sunday, mostly cloudy with a high near 70. Calm wind becoming southeast around 5 miles per hour in the afternoon.
It's 5:15. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Toward the end of his life, the civil rights champion and Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall was asked how he wanted to be remembered. "He did the best he could with what he had," Marshall replied. That's really the most any of us can do, and those who achieve it tend to make a lasting contribution to bettering our world, no matter who they are. Luckily, there are many such people across our land, working in our neighborhoods, cities, states, and occasionally at the national level, including Reverend Everett Parker, who recently died at 102 years old. In the early 1960s, he noticed that many television and radio stations were blatantly racist. They refused to cover the African-American community, ignored civil rights news, openly used on-air slurs and racist portrayals of black people, had no integrated programming, and failed to hire minorities. Others noticed this same institutional racism, of course, but Reverend Parker decided to do something. As the communications director of the United Church of Christ, he began to monitor stations and file actions with the FCC, the federal overseer of our public airwaves. In 1964, the commission conceded that Parker was correct, that discrimination was rampant, but decreed that viewers had no standing to challenge a station's license. But Parker kept pushing, and 5 years later, he and we won a court ruling that, quote, "a broadcast license is a public trust subject to termination for breach of duty." Since then, he and such allies as Public Citizen organized volunteers to monitor stations, demand reforms, and train minority broadcasters. This is Jim Hightower saying, over time, by simply doing the best he could, Reverend Parker's initiative and tenacity helped alter the whole industry's guiding ethic, recognizing, in his words, that to serve the public interest, they must, quote, "serve all the public."
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
And now for a two-minute lesson in labor history brought to you by Illinois Labor History Society.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1888. That was the day that the United Hebrew Trades was founded in New York City. The new effort was patterned after the United German Trades. The goal of the organization was to organize Yiddish-speaking workers. Individual Jewish workers had been active in the burgeoning U.S. trade union movement since the 1850s. But the United Hebrew Trades marked the first time for such a broad-based collective effort to organize Jewish workers. Three of the early founders were Bernard Weinstein, Morris Hilquit, and Abe Kane. Weinstein was a young shirtmaker turned union activist. Morris Hilquit would become one of the leaders of the American Socialist Party in the United States. Hilquit was born in Latvia and moved with his family to the Lower East Side of New York. Like many Jewish workers, Hilquit found a job in the city's garment industry. He later graduated from law school. Abe Kane was born in Belarus. He was one of the leading voices in Jewish journalism in the United States. In 1877, he founded the newspaper, The Jewish Daily Forward, which still exists today. Under the leadership of these men, the United Hebrew Trades quickly became a presence in New York City. In March of 1890, 4,000 Jewish workers commemorated the Paris Commune with a march through the city. They more than doubled that number just 2 months later on May Day. By Labor Day, 15,000 Jewish workers marched together. These public demonstrations showed the power of Jewish workers. By 1910, the United Hebrew Trades had swelled to 106 unions. 150 50,000 men and women were members, including thousands of Italians and other nationalities. By the 1930s, the United Hebrew Trades had reached its peak of 250,000 members. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
And now, the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. With a strike at Fiat Chrysler having been averted, UAW workers will soon be voting on that second tentative agreement. UAW leaders say significant gains were made in the second round of bargaining. The union's bargaining committee voted to send the proposed contract to local UAW leaders and their Chrysler Council. The UAW Chrysler Council will meet Friday in Detroit to review and vote on the tentative agreement. If they approve, the UAW plans to make details of the new agreement public immediately. Then it still must be ratified by rank-and-file UAW workers at Fiat Chrysler. UAW President Dennis Williams says leadership heard the members and went back to the table at Fiat Chrysler to strengthen the new labor agreement. Williams says he believes this new tentative agreement addresses UAW members' principal concerns about their jobs and their futures. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Mark Pocan this week introduced the Workplace Democracy Act. Senator Sanders says it would greatly strengthen the rights of American workers to join unions.
This legislation will make it easier for workers to join unions and collectively bargain for higher wages and stronger benefits. Under this legislation, when a majority of workers in a bargaining unit sign valid authorization cards to join a union, they will have a union. End of discussion.
United Food and Commercial Workers President Mark Perrone says talk at the White House Worker Voice Summit won't be enough. Perrone says action must be taken. Action, he says, to stop, quote, irresponsible employers that cut wages and benefits, misclassify workers as independent contractors or hire temporary workers to avoid responsibilities as an employer, and punish those who speak out and try to better their lives, end quote. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says Hillary Clinton's opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement has proven again that she is a champion for working people. The AFT endorsed Clinton for president in July. Weingarten says the TPP threatens to harm workers and the environment. While most Americans still struggle to get ahead, Weingarten says, trade agreements like the TPP only make their situation worse.
Let's get America working. We must build, maintain, and repair our nation's crumbling infrastructure. Teamsters support a bipartisan approach to creating good jobs for American workers. Learn more at letsgetamericaworking.com. Teamsters strong, America stronger.
Workers Independent News, made possible in part through underwriting support from the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union, and from the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Pentagon has abandoned its failed $500 million program to train, quote, moderate Syrian rebels. Instead, it will ramp up support for established and, quote, proven forces, including Kurdish fighters. The White House admits that building a force from scratch to combat the Daesh fighters, or ISIL, was more difficult than first thought. Pentagon spokesman Peter Cook announced the new strategy, saying that the U.S. will now provide equipment packages and weapons to a select group of vetted leaders and their units who are, quote, motivated to take back Syrian territory from ISIL, end quote. He specifically mentioned the Kurds, saying that the U.S. would build on a progress achieved by joint U.S.-Kurdish operations against ISIL in northern Syria. Friday's announcement comes more than a week into a bold Russian intervention on behalf of its ally, the Assad government.
Only days after both Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and Palestinian President Abbas spoke at the UN, claiming they were committed to de-escalate tensions, violence suddenly surged with Palestinian youth calling for another uprising or intifada against the Israeli occupation. The violence is spiraling, with funeral services for one of the Palestinian victims deteriorating into some of the most intense clashes in this latest round of escalated unrest. FSRN's Lena Odegaard reports from the West Bank.
Al-Quds, Palestine, Shuhada, Bin Malayin, For the past week, protests and violent clashes between stone-throwing Palestinian youth and Israeli military forces have spread to an increasing number of places throughout the West Bank. Casualties have grown significantly since the Israeli parliament recently approved the use of live ammunition against suspected stone throwers, even minors. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, Israeli forces have injured at least 1,200 people, 100 with live bullets, and killed seven, including 13-year-old Abdulrahman Obeidallah, as he headed home from school in Bethlehem. At a demonstration Tuesday at the Kalandia checkpoint close to Jerusalem, 70-year-old Samir Harimawi banged her cane while on the verge of tears, calling on the international community for support.
All the time there are killings and our houses are demolished and we face restrictions to pray at Al-Aqsa. Where is the world?
Tensions flared after an Israeli couple, Aitam and Naama Henkin, were shot and killed last Thursday as they returned to their home in an Israeli settlement close to Nablus in the West Bank. Since then, in a series of stabbing attacks, Palestinian perpetrators have killed at least two more Israelis and wounded more than 15. In response, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu banned Palestinians from entering the Old City of Jerusalem for 2 days, and Thursday installed metal detectors at entrances. The clampdown feeds Palestinians' fear that Israel is planning a takeover of the holy site Haram al-Sharif, home to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and known to Jews as the Temple Mount.
It doesn't matter if they kill us. We will do anything for Palestine and for Al-Aqsa.
Like many other Palestinian youth, 21-year-old Basil Obeid has lost faith in the Palestinian leadership's ability to negotiate peace and find a non-violent way to end the Israeli occupation.
We are rising up as one. If Abbas is against us and against the Intifada, we will refuse his words and start the Intifada.
Thursday, President Abbas said publicly he won't allow Palestinians to be dragged into more violence with Israel. But especially among Palestinian youth, frustrations with the lack of political improvement are high and tensions have been simmering for months. Last year's war in Gaza, in which more than 2,200 Palestinians and 71 Israelis were killed, is still a fresh wound for most Palestinians. And in the West Bank, this year alone, Israeli forces have killed at least 25 Palestinians. And while Israeli officials say Jewish extremists killed a mother, father, and their baby in an arson attack, it hasn't yet had any repercussions for the perpetrators. In the village of Orif, close to Nablus, 60-year-old Munir Hassan Saliman turns over a bucket of empty tear gas canisters and lets them fall to the ground, saying soldiers threw them in front of his house the day before, while his children were there. Saliman is working on a new house at the edge of the village, close to the Israeli settlement Yitzhar, which has a reputation for housing some of the most aggressive Israeli settlers. He says he faces daily harassment from soldiers as well as settlers. Though the international community deems Israeli settlements in the West Bank illegal, they have grown rapidly in recent decades. In several areas, the surrounding native Palestinian communities face ongoing settler violence where groups of Jewish extremists burn their fields, uproot crops, and attack houses, cars, and residents. In video taken in recent days and released by Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, Israeli vigilantes are escorted by soldiers as they set Palestinian trees and fields on fire. They came here with the soldiers, Saliman says as he points to the black burned-out hill opposite his house. Many speculate that a large-scale Palestinian uprising, a so-called Third Intifada, is on its way. At Tuesday's protest, however, political leader of the Fatah party, Amin Shoman, rejected this. For now. He said that so far, only a small number of Palestinians have taken to the streets. But if the situation deteriorates, he fears the worst.
We're speaking about a miserable condition now in West Bank and Gaza Strip. And we want to give the peace chance to make a peace in this area. If Netanyahu cannot understand this message, maybe the Intifada coming another time.
Lina Otgar, FSRN, in Ramallah in the West Bank.
Whole Foods Company is recalling and removing from its shelves Papillon Organic Roquefort cheese after government officials found evidence of Listeria monocytogenes in the uncut wheel of the cheese. All sell-by dates of the cheese have been affected. Once again, that's Papillon Organic Roquefort cheese from Whole Foods. As yet, there have been no reported illnesses or infections, but the bacteria does have a long incubation period, anywhere from 2 to 60 days. Listeria infections can be deadly, particularly to the very young and old, pregnant women, and people with compromised immune systems. Symptoms include high fever, severe headache, stiffness, nausea, abdominal pain and diarrhea. Pregnant women risk miscarriage or stillbirth. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Martin Dodge, Robin Ryan, Cliff Ferrella, and Jim Thompson. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH